They say the key to living green is in the little things you do. There's a lot of truth to that. But you know, sometimes it is much easier said than done. You're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. Tonight we look at the environment. And to prepare for the show, I decided to buy a particular book, do a little research, you know? I also thought maybe we could show how, with just a little bit of effort, you can do those small, eco-friendly things that can add up and make a big difference. The easy thing, of course, would have been just to stop at the Borders bookstore on the way home, right? But no. I checked the library system. 5 copies. Of course, they're all checked out for weeks. Nuts. So, I called all the used bookstores in the area.
Hi, looking for a particular book. Wonder if you can see if you might happen to have one.
Okay.
Looking for The Weathermakers by Tim Flannery.
Just a minute, I'll look. No, we don't.
It doesn't look like it right now, I'm sorry.
No, we've got one by Ben Bova. Not the one you're looking for.
Now, I could have called every used bookstore in the Twin Cities, but I do have other things to do with my life. And even if I found a copy, then it would be a choice between killing a tree for the book or burning gas driving across town. If I order online, not only do I waste packing material and the energy needed to ship it, but I have to wait a week. So, you know what?
Thank you for calling Borders Midway. Well, actually, it says we have 7 copies of both the hardback and the paperback.
What are you going to do? Did I mention this is a book about global warming? You know, it's not always so easy being green, even when your heart is in the right place. Here's a taste of what we heard when people gathered with us a few weeks ago to help choose the theme for this show.
Personal change is hard. Like, actually changing the way that you live, you know, that's hard.
Yeah, I recycle my newspapers and my bottles and, you know, my mascara, and I feel really good about that. But, you know, I get in my car and I drive when I could walk.
I mean, to a large degree in our society, there's a sense that the companies will figure it out, technology will change, that we don't really have to change.
I think it's really hard for us to be green because, in a way, it contradicts how we define ourselves as Americans.
The first thing you need is a tagline or a catchphrase or a title for this thing that people can get behind. Climate change just isn't sexy. Global warming, you know, sort of has the fear behind it.
Once there is a clear message, what is the answer? Tell me the answer to this, paper or plastic?
Maybe there is no answer to that question or no right answer. Maybe we'll get into that a little later in the show. The main battlefield to save the environment is not corporate boardrooms or government halls. It is the human mind. And that is our turf tonight for In the Loop. We're coming at this show from a certain starting point. Global warming is real and dangerous. And you know, we're going to stand with most of the world's scientists and say people caused it. And in theory, people can fix it. The question is, what will it take? Tonight's show is about getting past green, or at least, you know, the marketing idea of green, and getting results. We've got our house band, the Smarts, here in the UBS Forum at Minnesota Public Radio. So, whether you're with us in person, on the radio, on the web, or your portable audio player, please join us in the loop. Broadcast of In the Loop is supported by Summit Brewing Company, local brewer of Summit Extra Pale Ale and other fine beers. More information at summitbrewing.com. For decades now, the eco-conscious have warned that our planet is in trouble and urged people to do their part to save it. Some places have heeded the call, like Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's often lauded as one of the nation's greenest cities. It leads the Midwest in its use of renewable energy, and it has an extraordinary number of sustainable commuters. Close to 9,000 people ride bikes to work every day, even in February. People in Minneapolis are taking action. But we asked In the Loop's Sandon Totten to find out whether it's enough to make a difference.
When it comes to the environment, we all like to think we do our part. For most people, that means one thing.
I recycle and do things like that.
We recycle and all that stuff.
I definitely recycle.
And in Minnesota, that's more than just lip service. Minnesotans have an unusually high recycling rate, 41% of their total trash. That makes Minnesota the second best in the nation when it comes to recycling, just a hair behind Oregon. And that's something to be proud of, but it's hardly the whole picture. There's a blemish on Minnesota's Eco Report card. You only have to look a few feet from your recycling bin to see what it is. It's garbage.
So the bad news is that we continue to create more waste each year.
That's Mark Rust, the garbage guru for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. He says, in spite of all the recycling, Minnesotans continue to throw out more junk every year. Last year's average was 1.17 tons per person. Imagine a Volkswagen Beetle with a family of four inside and their pets. That's roughly the weight of the trash tossed out by each Minnesotan every year. It's slightly less than the U.S. average of 1.3 tons per person, but it's still almost double what countries like Japan or the United Kingdom produce.
I still would say that we're a throwaway society. People have busy lives, and how they manage their garbage, I mean, I don't think it's even on the radar screen.
But to make headway on global warming and pollution, Mark says it's going to take more than good recycling habits. We need to change how we think about almost every aspect of our lives. If that's the case, then the city of Minneapolis is ahead of the curve. Minneapolis is frequently ranked one of the 10 greenest U.S. cities by national magazines and organizations. Not only does it boast a first-class recycling program, but over the last 5 years, it actually managed to reduce its garbage. It's a national leader when it comes to green roofs, and it gets more of its energy from renewable resources than any other Midwestern city. For Minneapolis resident Gary Hoover, those facts are encouraging. The environment figures into almost everything he does, from the food he eats to the way he gets around the city. You see, Gary drives an SUV.
But it's different than sport utility vehicle. This is called a sensible utility vehicle because it doesn't burn any gas.
It's essentially a giant tricycle with a bench on the back. It can haul up to 800 pounds. Gary uses his trike to carry tools and building supplies. He's a green handyman. He took me for a ride around South Minneapolis on his human-powered vehicle. He says traveling this way gives him a different perspective.
The trees are gorgeous. There's some snow kind of gilding the tops of the branches, and it's just a lovely day. The one thing that oftentimes spoils the day is car exhaust. That's another ironic thing is because I pedal, I work hard, so I breathe hard. And I really inhale that exhaust. It makes me feel like I'm being punished for doing a good thing.
Gary may feel alone on the road, but when it comes to sustainable action, he's got some good company. Around 7:30 every morning, Deb and Doug Pierce sit down over coffee and lay out the day's battle plan.
Maybe I should set up another meeting through the Yahoo groups.
Now, do you think you'll engage more people that way as opposed to, you know, them coming to a meeting?
For the Pierces, living green isn't enough. They want others to go green as well. They sit on boards, chair committees, and speak publicly about the need for eco-action in Minnesota. Deb says it wasn't that long ago that people were clueless about global warming. Now, it's front page news.
I wanted to take the newspaper the last 2 days and run around, you know, all the neighborhood meetings with it. Look! Look!
People in her neighborhood are starting to get it. Deb feels like a tipping point is coming.
We're getting there. We're getting very, very close. It only takes 20 to 25% of the people to be solid behind something to turn the tide. That's it. That's all it takes.
But even in a green city like Minneapolis, where people are doing their part, car commuting is on the rise. The average driver is spending 43 hours a year burning gas in traffic. And while Minneapolis has managed to cut down its energy use, the state's numbers as a whole are going up. When all is said and done, Minnesota is pumping 146 million tons of greenhouse gases into the air every year. Gary Hoover admits he sometimes feels overwhelmed.
And I have to tell myself, you know, I can't control what other people do, but I can control much of what I do, and so that's what I have to focus on.
But that's the fundamental dilemma. Folks like Gary and the Pierces, they may be doing their part. Even whole cities like Minneapolis are making strides. But in the face of a culture with so many built-in bad habits, depending on individuals to go green may not be enough.
That's In the Loop's Sandon Totten. I'm Jeff Horwich. In the Loop is online at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop, where you can keep an eye on our blog, subscribe to our podcast, and listen to previous shows. Of course, you can give us feedback. And we've gotten lots of feedback already on our topic tonight. And I'd say it's run about 95% people who deeply care about saving the environment. And that's very encouraging. But here is a little bit wider view. In an NBC Wall Street Journal poll just a month ago, only one-third of Americans agreed that global warming was a serious problem that needed immediate action. So before we go any further tonight, we should hear a bit from that end of the spectrum. I found it recently at a rather everyday event, a suburban high school hockey game. Do you guys consider yourselves environmentalists? Do you consider yourselves green?
Tree huggers?
Not so much. We recycle and all that stuff, but I don't consider myself an actual tree hugger. We drive a Suburban and we drive an F-150, so we have gas guzzlers, so I think it's easier to do life the way we're doing it now.
You go out in the parking lot, there's probably tons of huge cars out there that are, you know, it's taking up tons of gas and pollution, and that's just, I guess, probably our way of living at this time. I don't think right now it's something that we have to do. It's a choice.
Doesn't really matter. I don't, you know, don't follow it. It's, you know, like politics or anything else. I really don't care about it, so I don't pay attention to it. So,
I mean, it's all over the news, you know, global warming and all that stuff.
It's all over the news and everything else. It's just another news thing, you know. I mean, you can believe what you want to believe, and it's just one of those deals.
Global warming. Does it worry you?
Yeah, I'm in the snowmobile business, so yeah, I'm aware of it.
In the snowmobile business?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So very, like, practically, it's a big thing for you. Do you feel like it's in your power to do much about it, or?
Not really. You know, it almost seems like, what, every 20 years or something it happens this way. It has no snow for 5 years, and then it will snow 10 years straight, you know, who knows? But they sure talk about that global warming a lot, and you wonder.
What do you wonder?
You wonder if we're changing.
You mean if it's for real this time?
Yeah.
Do you like to think of yourself as being, like, an environmentalist, like, concerned about it in a way you want to go out and, you know?
No.
Why is it?
I don't know. I don't think that there's anything we can do about it enough, you know? We're going to get out of the snowmobile business. That's what we're doing.
Perspectives from various folks I met out at a high school hockey game in Cottage Grove. It's fair to say they're among the large portion of America that is not particularly green. Now, many of us, myself included, want to be green. We know the kinds of things we're supposed to be doing. But stack those good intentions up against freedom, convenience, the urge to buy things, wanting to eat meat. I'll plead guilty to that one. You're not supposed to eat meat, but I do. I like meat. And the sense that even when you're doing your part, everyone else is letting the world go to pot. Well, our house band tonight, the Smarts, decided to have a run at those everyday decisions that we face. Joe Weissman, a bass player for the Smarts, why don't you give me just a brief lowdown on your new tune here?
Well, it's kind of about two things. One is a sort of a reminder to myself and anybody else who wants to take it, not to get too smug about your global citizenship credentials, because, as I like to say, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of the environmental movement. Also, it's two is just sort of my lame wish that somebody else would just force us to be better, because really I feel if it's up to every one of us, if it's up to me to do my part, we're doomed.
Well, the Smarts with a brand new song called A Winning Recipe for Failure.
Revving up your sport utility. Don't you know that polar bears are falling into the sea? Steal my clothes, get dry, 'cause I run this thing on high. Hey, you, they're spewing spray so your garden will be green. Why don't you just jump in a lake with a can of gasoline? But for me, that gentle stuff won't get my dishes clean enough. Take it to self-righteous inquisition, might just find me. Sign me. I'm off fair trade coffee. Stealthing knocks me off my high horse by force. Really gotta make it easy, 'cause the truth is we're all lazy. Yeah, it's got to start with someone. Wonder who that one will be. If it's really up to me. A winning recipe for failure.
Hey, you that get your clothes from a third world factory. They're working some poor kids you can buy for next to free. But red meat's still my crutch, and organic's twice as much. Just as dead too.
Can't get too self-righteous. Inquisition might just find me, consign me. I'm all free-range chicken, even that might sicken someone. Yum, yum. Sure, it's gotta be convenient. All we just can't be so lenient. It's got to start with someone. I wonder who that one will be. It's really up to me. That's a winning recipe.
The Smarts are Morris Engel on drums, Jimmy Kennedy on keys, and Joe Weissman on bass. I picked up a couple of saxophones to join in tonight. You're listening to In the Loop, online at minnesotapublicradio.org/in-the-loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. In the U.S., the world's largest producer of greenhouse gases, one-third of us say we think global warming is a serious concern. Just about half of us say we personally worry about it to some extent. Compare that to two-thirds of Germans and British, 87% of French people, and 93% of Japanese. Now, more of us are coming around all the time, but the clock's kind of ticking here. Maybe the real challenge to get Americans acting green runs as deep as our culture. After we got listeners together to talk about environmentalism a few weeks ago, I kept thinking about what one person had to say on this topic.
I think it's really hard for us to be green because, in a way, it contradicts how we define ourselves as Americans. We define ourselves as independent people who value privacy. Okay, in order to be independent, we get in our individual cars and we go where we want to, when we want to. We buy places out in the suburbs that are 5-acre, 10-acre lots now so that we can have our privacy. And we don't want to give that up.
Without a doubt, our American cultural touchstones are a potent weapon for those directly opposed to the environmental movement. I'm going to do my best to Rush Limbaugh for you here, quoting from a radio show where he called environmentalism a threat to America and our Constitution.
It is anti-capitalist. It is anti-freedom. It is pro-big government. It is pro-total control over as much of life as these people can engineer. And one of the things they do is live in a world of doom and gloom. Now, even if we don't agree with Rush, yes, I'm myself again now. Now, even if we don't agree with Rush, he plays upon values most Americans share: economic freedom, personal control over our lives, and optimism. And in subtle ways, it's no surprise these instincts hold us back a little bit. When environmentalists cry danger, that glances off many Americans, like Ron Stoffel, a mild-mannered accountant from Minneapolis who responded to our questions on the topic.
That, you know, isn't a good thing going forward and stuff, to be kind of the sky is falling, doom and gloom. To blow it out of proportion, I don't think helps either their image or what they're trying to get people to change by scaring people. I don't think that's the right way of doing it.
Is it at the heart of the American character to be skeptical like that?
To a certain extent, yeah, I think I may get back to, you know, how the country was founded is you don't want to be forced into something.
So for the environmental movement, the task is to play the American values game as well as Rush Limbaugh and get folks like Ron Stoffel on board. Lynette Zalesny is a professor of psychology at California State University, Fresno, who co-authored a paper on this very subject.
We see a great opportunity for the environmental movement to actually reframe the strategies of marketing environmental messages to Americans. We've really missed the mark in the past, which is one of the reasons that we feel it's been unsuccessful and why it's floundering currently.
In the language of psychology, Zalesny says the average American is egocentric rather than ecocentric. So don't talk to them about sacrifice and the common good. Many Americans hate that. Talk about energy independence. Don't dwell on ominous predictions. Talk about taking control of our future. Talk less about saving our great green home and more about saving green on our power bills. And don't talk about catching up to the rest of the world. Talk about beating them.
This is a remarketing of the strategy in trying to produce environmental behaviors, but not necessarily for environmental reasons.
Now, the movement might take a lesson from an obscure but growing hobby, something that's called hypermiling.
You know, you have people that are speed freaks, and then you have people that are fuel economy freaks, and I'd probably fit into the latter category.
I went for a ride the other day with Kevin Moot in his Honda Insight Hybrid. Kevin works in tech support. He's no raging environmentalist, never has been. It's good old American values like competition, self-reliance, and control that inspire him and other hypermilers to take their gas mileage very seriously, modifying their cars, sharing tips with each other, and overhauling their everyday driving habits.
I'm driving in the right lane here, and there's a few cars passing me on the left here. I'm going about 10 miles below the speed limit, and I'm accelerating very slowly at this point.
Now, I should say that right now Kevin's car is freezing, and his windows keep frosting up because using the defroster can kill your mileage. Hypermilers overinflate their tires, block their radiators, avoid using their brakes when possible, and will even turn off their cars on the highway to ride the tailwind created by semis. Not that Kevin, of course, does any of these sometimes illegal things.
I can't say anything that can be used against me in the court of law. No, but that's how the people that actually get over 100 miles per gallon in a Prius or a Honda, that's exactly what they'll do.
Here's the thing. Hypermiling is a sport, and many of the athletes are hardly hippie tree-hugger types. Kevin competed in an MPG race this summer in Wisconsin, where saving the earth took a backseat to red-blooded American competitive instinct.
It was surprising, you know, how pumped up people got and how competitive they were. As the day went on, you know, there was kind of a leaderboard who was getting the best mileage at the time. When it got up to about 150, people were just, you know, how can it get any higher than this? So obviously there's a huge competitive factor in there.
So it's like kind of the opposite of NASCAR, but with the same kind of adrenaline rush.
Exactly.
Psychologists tell us one of the deepest American instincts is control. For hypermilers, it's not about sacrifice. It's about seizing control of a new aspect of your life. It's a kind of control that doesn't exist yet for most of us who don't have a constantly changing MPG meter on our dashboard. For people with today's hybrid cars, it's that mileage reading, not the speedometer, that becomes the object of our American urge for personal control and achievement. Now, we wouldn't all be as obsessive as the hypermilers, but that mileage meter is a pretty remarkable example of how a specific change in our daily routine, a small evolution in how information is presented, can redefine those same American values that can hold us back. You're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich.
And right now, I've got a number of excellent guests joining us that are going to help us open up this topic a little bit in a way that will include our audience here in the UBS Forum at NPR, which I know contains a number of people who've got great experiences and stories to get into the mix. Let me introduce the people who we have with us here. Just to my right is Wendy Jedlicka, the owner of Jedlicka Design, which specializes in what she calls eco-aware design, especially packaging. She has designed better ways to package everything from beer bottles to skateboards, always with a mind to the impact of her work on the wider world. Thank you, Wendy. To her right, Elise Amel, who's a professor of psychology at the University of St. Thomas and a specialist in the relatively new field that's called conservation psychology. She studies why people do or don't respond to environmental messages, which is pretty much exactly what our show is about tonight. So we're very glad to have her here. And finally, Chuck Kelly. Chuck is the president of the Kirker Advertising Agency here in the Twin Cities. I first met Chuck a couple years ago while working on a story about an ad campaign that used a dog riding a monkey to sell Mexican food. Kirker's clients include some of the biggest names in the Midwest, including Target, 3M, and the Mall of America. They do not, I should say, specialize in environmental messages, but Chuck does know marketing, and he knows the mind of the American consumer. So we're very glad to add his perspective to the conversation. Thanks, all three of you, for being here. We just heard about low mileage becoming a competitive sport. And I'm wondering, along those lines, what other ideas can you throw out there, anything that comes to mind, for aligning American values with this idea of being green?
I actually would like to kick it off.
Go ahead.
I would have to say hyper-garbage-ism, if you want to call that a sport. Fabulous thing happened in Europe in probably the late 80s. They raised the tipping fee, that is the cost of taking a truck and eliminating the garbage into the landfill or incinerator or whatever. And so every person in Germany, as the example, had their garbage rates raised really high. This caused a consumer revolution. People would bring Tupperware from home, empty their cereal, rice, whatever they were buying at the end of the supermarket checkout line, and dump the boxes right there at the end of the line. This was the seed to change the packaging laws in Europe. Now Europe has some of the most restrictive packaging laws in the world. And Europe, I want to just like put this right on the top, is our number one trading partner. If we want to compete in the global marketplace, we need to be able to fit in with their laws. That includes Japan, that also includes Australia. Anybody that can afford to buy a U.S. product, we need to fit. So if we as Americans, this would be a great sport.
Well, let me ask you, Chuck, can you sell hyper-garbage-ism, if I remembered your term? I mean, can you sell any of this stuff that involves going out of your way, doing extra? How do you pitch that to the American people?
This is a huge problem, and it can be an overwhelming problem when you hear about global warming and what's going on in the environment. There has to be an opportunity for hope, an opportunity for success, an opportunity that each one of us individually can believe in something that's going to make a difference. And there also has to be hope and belief in the product that the person is purchasing.
But you see it from where you're sitting, and Elise, I'm sure you've seen this as well. Americans just want to buy stuff. First of all, can we have a harmony here between buying the concept of green and buying stuff? Or does something need to give? Elise, what do you think?
Well, we all like to be cool. And so it has to just be more common to do green things and to have it be sort of the cool thing to do. And not everything has to be that we purchase has to be new. I mean, there's lots of cool stuff out there that's already been bought. And, you know, you just buy it from somebody else and rotate, you know. So there are ways to make it cool.
Let's talk about crisis. When you read the new reports, when you watch An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's movie, when you hear stories about how much needs to be done, the message is clearly shifting into the mode of, you know, we're all going to die if we don't get busy and do this now. And even if that is the truth, isn't it kind of the exact opposite from what you want to tell people to get them motivated?
Yes, I would agree with you. Certainly there are problems. But I think one of the things that people are looking for, consumers are looking for, and I think we're all looking for, is the problem's been defined, but help us with some solutions.
Although there is quite a bit of information about where the biggest bang for your buck can be and how you change things, we don't have a very good understanding of it currently, sort of in the general population. So one of the things that people, that you've mentioned here, is that people recycle, and that's like, you know, their part. And while we wouldn't want people to stop recycling, you know, there are far greater things that people can do in terms of impact.
And Wendy, you can talk a lot about this, working on sustainable packaging. Does recycling get us very far?
Well, actually, O2 is part of a global green design network, and that's what I'm very active with. And from our standpoint as designers, we are jumping around with excitement because we have been designing for pretty and creating what is, in essence, fatal beauty. It is products that we make, they're gorgeous, but they're killing us. PVC is a great example. It's poisonous on all levels. But now we're looking at design in a more holistic way. As we start to look at things, we're looking at how can we make this thing more energy efficient as we produce it? How can I make it a little bit smaller so it uses less energy to transport? So it's a multi-layered thing, and this is what really charges us up.
Now, to get people charged up, I mean, you want them to not run away from the concept. You know, when we've floated the idea of green to various people, some people say, yes, absolutely, I love green. I wear green every day. Some people say they just recoil from that concept. Elise, I know you've studied that to some extent. When you test people, not just on the word green, but say the word environmentalist, what do you find? Does it work for everybody?
Well, environmentalist doesn't work for many people, actually. Even people who are sort of by definition environmentalists don't consider themselves environmentalists. They don't like the label. They respond much better to terms such as conservation, even, which is a fairly traditional term, but things like green living and sustainability and stewardship.
Now, let me just say that at this point, if anybody wants to get in on the conversation, get a hand up. We'll get a microphone to you. I might be looking the other way. We have one right here in the front row.
I'm Andy from St. Paul. I'm wondering how recycling got to be so accepted, if that's something that people just, I recycle, but they think environmentalism is kind of a swear word. How did we win people over with recycling?
Anybody want to take that?
Sure. Recycling is a very public thing for most people. It's out on the front curb. And so when we see what the appropriate thing to do is in our neighborhood, then we do it. We respond very strongly to norms and the pressures from other people to do certain things in certain situations.
Well, so let's take that question and push it forward to where he went with it, which is to say, how do we apply this to other stuff? You know, to say, don't get plastic bags. This is a big one, you know, and it's hard for me because you just wind up with plastic bags. I mean, Walgreens throws them at you, and what are you going to do, right? Well, what you're supposed to do is carry your own tote around all the time. I don't know if anybody in our audience does that. I'd like you, if you do, maybe you can explain, how did you get, yeah, a lot of people, very good. Good for you all. How do you get over that hump? What would be your sort of the pressure you would put on the other folks in this room, on me, to get us to switch?
My name is Gordon from Arden Hills. You usually get somebody to give you the bags. And if somebody gives you the bags, you're kind of incentivized right away to start using them.
So who gave you the bags?
Actually, I got them through work originally. I got three of them as a Christmas bonus. So... And it stuck, so I use them all the time.
We've got some other people who want to respond to that one. How did you make the leap from out of the world of plastic bags?
My name is Michelle, and I'm from Wisconsin. And I personally shop at a particular discount grocery store where if you don't bring your own bag, they charge you for a bag. But I find it a huge incentive because I don't want to pay 25 cents for that bag.
I know Aldi's does that. I don't know if you're talking about Aldi's, but Aldi's, by the way, is a German chain, not surprisingly. Let me ask about this whole conversation. Chuck, I'm interested in your perspective, and then we'll spread it around. Global warming has been very big in the last month. You know, this UN report was coming out, all the things that we were thinking about when we were trying to decide what to do a show on. For a while there, it was global warming all the time. And then, of course, you know, Anna Nicole Smith and the astronaut, and suddenly I wasn't seeing anything about global warming again on CNN. How do you deal with the attention span issue? And I ask this of somebody whose job it is to hold people for 30 seconds and then let them go.
30 seconds if we're lucky. You know, there are holding a people's attention span means that you deliver the message at the right time when they're in the mood to receive the message. And I'll give you one example. We've been talking a little bit about Europe here. Another where they are leading us is Tesco is a large grocer in the UK and expanding to other parts of Europe and I think also to the U.S. as well. One of the things that they are requiring on the products that are carried in their store is carbon labeling.
So no longer will you just look for the nutritional labeling, you'll also look for carbon labeling. How many carbons were required to produce the product you're about to buy? Little by little, consistently, keeping the same message going will work over time, but it's got to be given time as well.
Let me just say you're listening to In the Loop on Minnesota Public Radio. Do you feel like we've gotten to the end of the people who are going to jump in because this is just about doing the right thing?
What will work with people? Do I think that it's we're going to quickly get to the next phase of this whole development of being with the green marketing? Yes, I do. You know, there are the so-called early adopters. Are we getting to the point where early adopters have adopted, and now to get into a larger group and a more difficult group to crack? We probably can't do the same things with people who were wanting to adapt this really fast, but we have to be smart. We have to be approachable. We also have to listen to what this group of people want so we can make sure that we are successful in communicating to them in a way that's going to sustain the environment as well.
How many of you in here, and I'm going to ask for somebody to obviously speak up and voice this with us in the UBS forum, feel like it's time to just force me and force everybody else, force my neighbors, you know, government, do it, make it happen. Right there.
I've heard a lot of people saying recently that Americans are so set in their ways and don't want their privacy invaded. But if you think about every time you take a flight, how many articles of clothing you have to remove, and it's because we're told it's a threat and there are regulations. And I think that same sort of thing has to happen as far as going green. We have to be told that this is what we have to do because this is a threat.
Now, I wonder if there's anybody who would want to take up the call on the other side of that and say, maybe threat is not the best way to approach this. Let's go in the back there.
My name is Adam. I'm from St. Paul. And I think it might actually, not that I disagree entirely, but I think it might actually work a better way. What the woman from Wisconsin was saying a little earlier was actually incentivizing good behavior. If you bring your bag, you save money. Instead of, you know, knowing that you're doing something bad by driving 2.1 miles to work like I do every day, maybe finding a way to incentivize or make it better for me and better for the world to, you know, do the right thing in that situation.
Our panelists want to jump back in on that one quickly. Elise first.
What you're saying is really spot on in that people respond with a lot of negative baggage to punishment and tend to maybe do the right thing sort of at the moment, but then when they're left to their own devices, they'll just go back to their usual stuff. Whereas if you reward for good behavior, it sort of becomes the new habit. It becomes part of how you identify yourself, and then you're doing it because it's part of you.
Wendy.
Part of what's working in the European model is they've started to do a thing called attaching true costs. But what the idea is that it levels the playing field. We're going to assume that everybody is having bad behavior, and the better behavior you have, the cheaper it gets for you. So this is one of the arguments that I get from people in, you know, the manufacturers that I serve is, well, you know, my competitor is doing this, and so I have to be equally as bad. And I'm like, well, okay, let's level the playing field. Assume everything we do is bad. Tax for it, because that's why gasoline in Europe is so expensive. It's taxes to be able to pay for health care, road maintenance, da-da-da-da, and then go from there.
This is a pretty depressing view of human nature we get to at this point when you start thinking about having to presume everybody is bad. I guess we're just beyond trying to explain to people that they should do it for the good of everybody?
No, I don't think bad is good in this example. I will just hearken back to late October and November when there were just too many bad ads on TV, and they were political ads. And they told us how bad the other person is and how bad that person is. And, you know, it was the most refreshing thing is it was to have elections over so we didn't have to hear night after night after night how bad things are. I think that it becomes depressing. So what we need and we need to believe in, and marketers and products and everything involved with green needs to, in a believable way, in a truthful way, in a way that is truly going to work, give people a reason to believe, give people an incentive, give people hope, and give people a view of the future that is realistic, but not just bad.
Putting aside the urgency of the situation, is there something intrinsically wonderful about choice, getting there by choice, presuming we could do that? Let's go in the back there if we could.
My name is Bridget, and I'm from Minneapolis. I think what is so great about choice is it gives us an ability to be creative and an individual. People can make choices in their everyday lives in several different facets. It can be transportation. It can be their housing. It can be the way that they dispose of things or the way that they intake things. And I think that's a great American thing, too. I mean, I think if you do enforce too many regulations, it's going to greatly reduce creativity, and that's also going to stifle sort of possible advancements we can make in the future that would actually enhance some things that could still happen.
Let's grab one more from the audience and then maybe go back quickly to our panel here. Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, I'm Ken from Minneapolis, and my wife Crystal and I, we track our energy usage, but not necessarily for carbon. I mean, that's part of it, but part of it, if you look at what you use in energy, there's a huge amount of money attached to it. We're talking about the choices we currently make as Americans and the values we set to own all of this stuff really is thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars every year for most Americans. So don't be average. Don't own two cars. Use less. By using less, you can save more and really have a better lifestyle in the end.
Thank you. Let's go once more quickly down our panelists here. Wendy, jump in here and respond to what we've been hearing.
Well, I really dig gaming the system. You know, as gas prices go up, I'm like, okay, I've set up my lifestyle so I don't have to drive much. And, you know, it's like, yeah, bring on $5 a gallon. I'm all for it. I love big furry cats. And so I have two very large, very furry cats. So I can keep my house temperature down at about 62. And I just wear more polar fleece. And we look at our energy bill and it's just tiny compared to some of my neighbors. So I just really dig gaming it. You know, that's half of why I thrift shop. I just dig the hunt.
Gaming the system. That's as American as cheating on your taxes. Hey! People love it. Elise, final word from you.
Well, a lot of what we've been talking about assumes that we have that we spend a lot of time on our choices, and when in fact many of our choices just are habitual in nature. And so part of the solution is going to be opening a mental space to make the choices that we want based on our goals, as opposed to because it's the thing we've always done, it's a habit, it's you know, just the common thing.
Chuck Kelly, advertising agency president, let me just ask you very directly, do you feel like your business is changing, is going to change in the next couple of years because of these forces?
Dramatically. It's a responsibility we have to the to our clients, and it's also consumers will not allow us to be otherwise. Consumers are going to expect products, and the way we talk to consumers, are these products responsible? Are they doing what is going to help us be successful in solving a huge problem? And that information is going to be essential in communications, and if it's not truthful, these brands are going to be blogged to death.
Chuck Kelly, president of the Kirker Advertising Agency. Elise Amel from the University of St. Thomas and Wendy Jedlicka of Jedlicka Design. Thank you for being here. Thank you to our extraordinary audience for all your contributions. We've got a bit more of the show to go, so stay with us. You know, one of the challenges in convincing people to go green is that Americans are used to the idea that technology can swoop in and fix our problems. In that spirit, Richard Branson, the flamboyant CEO of the Virgin Group, just offered a $25 million prize to the person who invents a way to take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and store it away. Wouldn't that be nice? You know, a nice big CO2 vacuum, no need for the rest of us really to change much about our unsustainable lifestyles. Well, we asked reporter Dan Olson to explore our faith in technology. Is it hype or genuine hope?
40 years ago, the environmental crisis was acid rain threatening the world's forests and lakes, and speed of light doesn't quite describe how we responded to that threat. As early as 1850, the British government knew the soft coal being burned in the country emitted smoke that created sulfuric and nitric acid carried to Earth by rainfall. It took more than 100 years, 1968, before scientists sounded the alarm that acid rain was waging what amounted to chemical warfare on forests and lakes. 10 years after that, 1978, University of Minnesota ecologist Evel Gorham and other scientists handed President Jimmy Carter a plan to solve the problem.
We could fix it by reducing sulfur emissions largely, and that's gone fairly well.
Well enough, in fact, that acid rain, while still an issue, is much less of a threat. The 81-year-old Gorham is retired now. He's a tall, courtly native of Canada. He acknowledges that technology and human intervention have helped avert other environmental crises. The growth of the world's burgeoning population is slowing. The chemicals creating the ozone hole have been largely outlawed. And there's progress in cleaning up polluted lands and waters. So you might guess Gorham would be an optimist when it comes to solving global warming. But he's not. He says climate is different from those other crises. Why? Because it isn't due to just one thing. It involves all of the Earth's ecosystems, and Gorham says we don't know how all the pieces fit together. What if, he says, the world's peat deposits, vast beds of decayed plant matter, were to dry out from global warming and catch fire?
We get those forest fires on the peatland forests, sinking into the peat, which can smolder and dump CO2 into the atmosphere for decades.
Evel Gorham fears the problem is too big and people are too small-minded to solve it.
In my 81 years, I have not seen an accompanying growth in wisdom and in what I might call loving kindness or concern for the least fortunate among us. And I think our grandchildren are going to pay a terrible price for that.
Not a happy outlook from one of the world's most eminent ecologists. That's one side of the coin. The other side is Gorham's good friend and fellow University of Minnesota ecologist Clarence Lehman. Lehman says climate change is like earlier problems we've fixed, just on a larger scale.
With known technology today, there are 15 things that any 7 of which, if we do them now in a sustained effort for 50 years, will hold carbon constant in the atmosphere. That buys 50 years.
50 years, Lehman says, to find new ideas and technology that will actually reduce carbon levels. Until then, he says, we can apply what we already know. Energy-conserving technology for buildings, more fuel-efficient vehicles, alternative energy including clean coal and nuclear power, can be used on a vast scale, he says, to stop the projected doubling of carbon dioxide emissions. Lehman says the effort will take political will.
For very short-term things, legislatures must act. For the longer-term things, the public must act. For the really long-term things, the only thing that matters is the young people.
Lehman pins his hopes for more advanced technology to solve global warming on today's kids. And there's no shortage of ideas from the younger generation, at least among 5th and 6th graders at the Susan Lindgren Intermediate School in the Minneapolis suburb of St. Louis Park.
Then we harness the solar power.
What if Earth is blown up?
Some of their ideas are, well, imaginative. Colonizing other planets if things go badly here, or building a dike-like wall around countries to hold back rising oceans as glaciers and ice caps melt. And these kids get practical, too.
Another thing would be only to use 2 punts of paper towel when wiping your hands to save paper.
A way we could be more energy efficient is by using earth insulation. If you dig deep enough, the natural earth temperature is 55 degrees. With that steady temperature, it would save energy from heating and cooling homes.
My family takes long showers, so everyone could take away 5 minutes of energy, so we'd save 20 minutes of using water.
There's even a promising speechwriter in the group ready to market the need to conserve.
One person that's energy efficient is one step closer to an energy efficient world.
For these young people, it's not about waiting for technology alone to fix the world they will inherit. They assume that we have to change too. And perhaps that's the lesson for the rest of us. Global warming, if we can solve it, will take science, creativity, and one person at a time becoming energy efficient.
That was Minnesota Public Radio reporter Dan Olson. You are listening to In the Loop. You know, those kids have lots of ideas and energy for saving the planet. But what they don't have is something many of us now in our 20s grew up with, an environmental cartoon superhero to lead the way. I'm talking about Captain Planet. And if you don't remember Captain Planet, you missed out on one of the most kitschy, most bald-faced, most endearing attempts to market environmentalism to children. But just as suddenly as he had appeared, Captain Planet vanished from our lives. And no one has quite been able to fill his skin-tight red boots. Now, our staff at In the Loop got to wondering, what happened to the guy? Then, we ran across this obscure radio segment, which helps fill in some of the blanks.
Welcome to another edition of Where Are They Now? I'm Casey Kasem. The year was 1993. Bill Clinton became president. The Spin Doctors were on the radio. The Buffalo Bills had lost three consecutive Super Bowls, and a new hero was changing the face of Saturday mornings.
By your powers combined, I am Captain Planet! Captain Planet!
Since bursting from the mind of Ted Turner in 1990, the blue skin and emerald mullet of Captain Planet had become synonymous with clean living and a green future. With the help of five teenage planeteers, pollution problems mounting since the Industrial Revolution began to recede. Entrenched patterns of environmental degradation gave way to a single, enlightened philosophy.
The power is yours!
These were heady days for Captain Planet and the Planeteers, culminating in the captain's historic 1993 speech to the United Nations General Assembly. But behind the scenes, the delicate ecosystem of the crime-fighting team was beginning to unravel.
The power is yours? Right. Jeez, I can't believe we bought into that garbage.
Wheeler, the Planeteer from the United States, says the team's interests were wandering.
So that kid Kwame from Africa, he scored a Super Nintendo, and we were, like, seriously playing that thing all the time. And the girls and us, you know, we're like 16. I mean, at a certain point, you get more interested in chasing each other than, like, industrial polluters.
Wheeler and Asian Planeteer Guy were the first to drop out of the Planeteers, cashing in their rings of power to launch a startup company selling pet food over the internet. Captain Planet and the remaining Planeteers struggled on, but the final blow to the team came soon, like an exaggerated karate kick to the head. The age of the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers had arrived. America's children deserted the non-violent, Earth-friendly message of the Planeteers for laser beams and fake-looking judo chops. For nemeses of Captain Planet, like the evil businessman Loot and Plunder, it was a welcome relief.
So you remember what happened in 1993, right? NAFTA, baby, NAFTA. And where was your precious Captain Planet? Not at my factories in the Mexico border region, that's for sure. Now, who had the last laugh, Captain Planet? Who had the last laugh?
These were dark years for Captain Planet. Though briefly considered for the post of EPA administrator, the Clinton White House decided his blue skin and origins shrouded in the mists of time would make the Senate confirmation process difficult. Captain Planet shaved his trademark green mullet and embarked on a journey to find himself. He traveled the globe, eventually landing at a remote Himalayan retreat run by an old friend, Woodsy Owl.
The captain arrived a broken, blue man. Smokey the Bear and I appealed to him to reach down deep inside himself, to keep going, to give a hoot.
Thus began the quiet recovery of the world's forgotten ecological hero. He reestablished his links with the environmental community, eventually settling an old dispute with former Vice President Al Gore over who discovered global warming. He became a creative consultant, working behind the scenes on movies like The Day After Tomorrow, Happy Feet, and, through a slight miscommunication, The Green Mile.
Take my hand, you see for yourself.
The struggle for the hearts and minds of America's children, of course, is more difficult than ever. Earth-friendly messages fight a pitched battle against video games, iPods, and High School Musical. But if you listen closely, beneath the din, you can still hear him saying, "The power is yours." For Where Are They Now? I'm Casey Kasem.
Thank you for the voice talents of Robin Johnson, Jeff Nelson, and John Ryan helping me out with that. This is In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. We've got one more stop before we end tonight. You know, I was thinking about this process we're all going through of waking up to these difficult truths, inconvenient truths, you might say, about the challenges we're facing. It's a tough learning process that might not make us happier right away, but it will certainly make us wiser once we go through it. And I thought, you know, that sounds a lot like a country song. And so we have one for you, a tune called Guess It's Better That Way. And it starts the way so many good country songs do.
dog ran away. My woman just left me. I just watched Al Gore. It completely depressed me. With his charts and his graphs, he stole all my laughs and left me with nothing to say. Now I'm feeling sad, guess it's better that way. My old truck broke down, and I'm so unhappy. Suppose it's for the best, 'cause the mileage was crappy. The glaciers are melting and I wasn't helping by driving that old Chevrolet. Gonna miss old Bess, yeah, but it's better that way. Now let me tell you something. My carbon footprint was out of control.
How big was it?
Let me tell you, 15,000 pounds a year. Hard to believe, ain't it? Well, I was so happy living on gas, oil, and coal till Al's little slideshow put this teardrop in my beard. That's Al Gore on that dirt piano.
Seems relaxed, doesn't he?
Playing the blues. Play it out. Oh. I feel a little better. My life was so simple, and my ignorance blissful. I took such long showers, tossed plastic bags by the fistful. I did. Now I'm riding my bike, bought those curly Q lights, turned the thermostat down yesterday. Yeah, I know it's a little cold in here, but it's better that way.
Better that way.
The world's warming up. There are hurricanes coming. If the bummers keep growing, well, then I guess I'll keep bumming. If Al Gore can still smile even once in a while, then I guess I can get by, okay. Yeah, I'm a little sad, but it's better that way.
Better that way.
The cast of In the Loop is supported by Summit Brewing Company, local brewer of Summit Extra Pale Ale and other fine beers. More information at summitbrewing.com. In the Loop is online at minnesotapublicradio.org/InTheLoop. Sign up for the podcast, keep an eye on the blog, and tell us what you think. A couple of thank yous as we wrap up here this evening. Our volunteers tonight helping make this live show happen, Jen Hauk, David Jonas, and Molly Bloom. Jeremy Pavlek is taking photos for us this evening. Our engineer is Sam Keenan. Josh Kubasta is the technical director of the UBS Forum. Additional engineering help for us this time from Mike DeMark and Mark Brule. Our assistant producer is Sandon Totten. Our technical producer is Alan Freckman. The executive producer of In the Loop is Michael Scholar. My name is Jeff Horwich. Thanks to our audience for being here. Thanks to everybody, of course, who just listened to this program we had tonight. Hope we'll see you next month in The Loop.